Hi, my name is Brian Backinson. I'm with our Bureau of Communicable Disease Control here in the New York State Department of Health. With me is Dr. Elizabeth Dufort. She's our medical director for the Division of Epidemiology, also here at the State Department of Health. This is the second in a set of four different webinars that we're doing to kind of get updates, get new information out to the physician community with regards to Zika virus. We realized that we had done some back in February and March, and we hadn't done some in a while, so this is our opportunity to get some information back out to the medical community. We think these are really important for us, and we'd really like your cooperation with regards to being able to, you know, share the word that you hear today with your colleagues, with other individuals. Zika is going to be with us for a number of years, maybe not as intense as it has been this year, but it will be something that's going to be around for a while, and a lot of the messages you're going to wind up hearing today are ones that we're going to use as we try and normalize Zika. As Zika becomes kind of just another disease, similar to West Nile did 16 years ago. So we're going to need your help with regards to being able to, you know, share whatever information you learn in this particular webinar, in yesterday's webinar, in the webinars over the next couple of days to with your colleagues. So, to that end, page down. Where am I going? Here. Yeah, that's what I was trying to do. Because you got to go over to the pen. Are you still in annotate? Oh, okay. Okay. All right. Sorry about that. So basically what we're going to do is we're going to review kind of the current status of the Zika virus epidemic. We're going to talk about some new data on transmission patterns, the clinical presentation, complications, and maternal fetal transmission. We're going to talk a little bit about prevention. And we're going to talk about some of the testing recommendations and processes here in New York State. Like I mentioned at the very top of the webinar, this is the second of five different webinars that are going to be talked about. I don't really expect you to read this. This is a little difficult. There was one yesterday where we were trying to get at OB and neonatal providers. There's going to be one tomorrow on transplant-associated issues with regards to Zika. There's going to be one next week for pediatric providers, and then there's going to be a large one you can see here on the right, an update on Zika virus for primary care providers. This is going to be kind of the commissioner's grand rounds. It's going to be Thursday, September 29 in the evening. If you happen to be at or near Stony Brook School of Medicine, you could also go see that one live. Oh, I should add before I start that this particular webinar is being taped, and the slides will be made available on our public website probably within a few days after this after today. So the basics of Zika virus, we're going to go through probably some things a little bit more quickly than others. The basics of Zika, we in many ways presume that you've kind of kept up with what's going on with regards to Zika. But Zika is a single-stranded RNA virus in the genus Flavivirus. It's closely related to dengue, yellow fever, Japanese encephalitis, and West Nile, all of which are flaviviruses. These are kind of fall into the group we call arboviruses, and they're transmitted to humans primarily through the bites of infected mosquitoes and other arthropods, though there certainly are other ways that they can get transmitted as well. The clinical presentation, and this is a slide that we gave back when we first were starting to do some of these webinars, the clinical presentation of Zika really hasn't changed much in the past 9 months of what we've learned. It hasn't changed much since what we kind of knew about Zika back then from some from previous studies. The infection rate is still about 75%. The symptomatic attack rate, the number of cases we see from the people that are infected, is still just about 20%. Every age group is affected. Adults are more likely to present for medical care. There really is not much in the way of severe disease, hospitalization, or death without some sort of pre-existing condition. The main symptoms that we wind up seeing are a macular or a papular rash. There may be fever and arthralgia. Conjunctivitis is something that we've seen in a number of cases, and we've heard about in cases here in the United States and New York and in Central and South America. headache, retroorbital pain, edema, and vomiting as well. There is no specific treatment for Zika at this particular point in time. Main treatment is supportive, basically rest, fluids, analgesics, antipyretics. Suspected Zika viruses should be evaluated and managed for possible dengue or chikungunya virus infections, many of which look very similar to Zika. And you probably ought to avoid using aspirin or NSAIDs until you can rule out dengue, because in some cases, dengue can lead to hemorrhagic fever, and those aspirin and NSAIDs can exacerbate that. As you mentioned a couple seconds ago, the clinical illness is usually mild. It lasts for about several days to a week or so. There are instances of severe disease requiring hospitalization, but in most cases, those are uncommon. I think we've had one or two fatalities, and again, most of those have been associated with pre-existing conditions. Neurologic complications, which we'll talk about shortly, can be a concern, specifically Guillain-Barré, but those are quite rare as well. And the picture here is a rash of a Zika case that we've seen. So this is a study that looked at basically the first half of this year for the 50 states and the District of Columbia. It was published in MMWR. And looking at this, of this 2,300 cases, 65, only 3% were hospitalized. And of those, they were in the hospital for about 3 days. 11 of those were diagnosed with a viral illness. 2 had a possible respiratory infection. 6 had further clinical, needed further clinical evaluation. 1 had exacerbation of an underlying condition. 1 had septic shock. 6 patients had neurologic manifestations, including 5 with GBS, 1 with paresthesias. And we did have 1 patient die. This patient died of septic shock with multiple organ failure. So again, the main thrust here, though, is even though there can be some severe manifestations that require hospitalization, the number of those compared to the number of confirmed or probable cases is still quite small. Zika is still a relatively mild disease in the vast majority of people who get it. This zooms in a little bit more on Guillain-Barré and looks at it in Puerto Rico for this same particular time. As you know, Puerto Rico has had an awful lot of cases compared to the continental United States, and they've had an awful lot of localized cases as well. And the particular graph you wind up seeing here on the left shows basically the light blue, the two kind of top colors on the most right-hand column are indicative of Guillain-Barré in Zika. Well, it's all indicative of Guillain-Barré, but those are confirmed and probable Zika cases. And basically, if you look at the proportion of those bars that are made up of those two top colors, you can see it increasing from left to right as the months go on, basically showing that the more Zika that's happened in Puerto Rico over that particular period of time, there's been a higher proportion of Guillain-Barré cases that have been reported, particularly in Zika cases as well. But again, the numbers are really quite low. On the right, you wind up seeing here that we've only had 7 cases of 56 cases total, and then 7 with other neurologic disorders that may be indicative of Zika as well. We're still asking physicians, laboratories, and whatnot to report suspect Zika virus cases to their local health department where the patient resides, not necessarily the county where the medical provider's office is. We ask you to report to where the patient resides. And this kind of reporting still allows us to work with local health departments to kind of assess and reduce risk of potential local transmission or potentially mitigate further spread. While mosquito season is going to start to wrap up over the next month or so, we still are concerned a little bit about locally acquired cases, and knowing about cases lets us investigate them fully and try and determine whether or not there really is any risk of locally acquired transmission. So if we start to shift gears now and look kind of around the world where Zika is going on, in the very beginning of this, back in December and January of last year and this year, the number of countries involved in Zika has really increased. And what we can see now is we basically have practically the entire Western Hemisphere has had locally acquired Zika cases of one sort or another. And now it's a little difficult to see, but in one of the box kind of on the left within this box kind of shows parts of Asia as well. And we're starting to see, you may have heard news reports about cases in places like Singapore, and there have been increases in the number of cases in Asia as well. CDC and WHO and other countries are certainly working to try and figure out the spread that may go on in Asia. And I think there are some concerns about what other countries it may wind up going into and what could be done to potentially prevent in Asia the type of outbreak that we saw in Central and South America. If we look in the United States, this is as of September 14. These are CDC data. We've had just over 3,100 cases in the United States in the District of Columbia. Only 43 of those have been locally acquired, and mosquito-borne cases in Miami. We'll get to that in a second. Over 3,100 of them have been travel-associated. We've had 26 sexually transmitted cases, one case of laboratory transmission, eight cases of Guillain-Barré syndrome. New York, maybe surprisingly, maybe not, has had the most cases in the United States. All of those have been travel-associated. But New York, because it is such a travel hub, particularly in the New York City metropolitan area, is definitely we definitely see lots of cases of Zika virus come through travel into New York City. Puerto Rico has a lot of locally acquired cases. People may not necessarily appreciate the magnitude of cases that are in Puerto Rico. Puerto Rico has had over 17,000 locally acquired cases in Puerto Rico thus far. Particular demographic categories that people may be interested in: pregnant women with any lab evidence of Zika virus infection in the U.S. is 731. This is as of September 8th. These are individuals that are being kind of followed by states and CDC to try and look for potential outcomes from Zika virus in their children. And of those so far, some have given birth, some have not. In those that have given birth, we've had 18 live-born infants with birth defects and had five pregnancy losses, again, and this is nationwide. This is part of an ongoing study that's probably going to go on at least a year or so. If we look at New York State now, this is split into New York State on the left-hand side and New York City on the right-hand side. New York State, we've had just under 800 cases. New York State has had 186. No locally acquired cases. New York City has had 566. Again, no locally acquired cases. We've had six sexually transmitted cases in the state. We've had four Guillain-Barré cases in the state. And we've had two infants with birth defects. All told, I think we've had 81 individual pregnant women that are being followed as part of the pregnancy registry that CDC is putting together. I want to point your attention to the link here in red at the top of this particular slide. This is our Mosquito-Borne Disease Weekly Report. It gets posted every Wednesday, sometimes Thursday mornings. And it's basically about a 10, 11-page document that has a number of different tables and graphs and kind of updates for what's going on during the course of the week, as well as tables by county and assorted maps like you wind up seeing here. And it's not just specifically for Zika, but it talks about West Nile virus. It talks about Eastern equine encephalitis. It talks about dengue. It talks about chikungunya. It talks about malaria as well. And basically, it's a pretty good resource for you to kind of get an idea of what's going on with regards to mosquito-borne diseases in New York State. One of the questions that we've gotten an awful lot of over the past month is what's going on in Florida, and should we be concerned about our patients who have had travel to Florida? Locally acquired Zika in the United States has been limited basically to two areas of Miami. One is in Wynwood. It's this little yellow block that you see on the kind of upper right-hand side of this particular figure. So it's not all of Miami. It's one particular area here, there, in yellow. And then Miami Beach, kind of an area almost just across a bridge from that area, pictured here in red. CDC has put out travel advisories to these two areas, and these areas have done enhanced mosquito control. And then just yesterday or the day before, CDC has kind of lowered the risk for the Wynwood area because there have been basically three generations of mosquito population generations that have happened, and there have not been any additional cases associated with Wynwood. So Wynwood is kind of now in the area of kind of taking extra precautions, but the travel advisory has kind of been lowered from what it once was for that particular area of Miami. And if you're not familiar with Miami, these are not very large areas in terms of geography. They are quite small. You also may have heard about other locally acquired cases in other places throughout Florida, but these are the only places that have been identified by CDC as having locally acquired cases, and the only ones where CDC has put out any travel advisories for those. So we've had a lot of questions about places like Orlando or Jacksonville or Tampa, and again, there's no, at this point in time, no travel advisories for those particular areas. Though doing good mosquito control is always a good idea. So for the rest of this, we're going to wind up going through a number of different modes of transmission. Then we're going to wind up talking a little bit about labs. So the first thing I'll do is we'll talk a touch about mosquito bites and transmissions from via mosquito. The vectors for Zika virus are Aedes species of mosquito, and in particular, two different species of Aedes. Aedes aegypti is one of the most efficient vectors of Zika virus because of how it behaves, how it interacts with people, where it breeds, what it likes to breed in. Aedes albopictus is a possible vector for Zika. It's been shown to be able to transmit it in the lab. Its natural history, the way it acts, the way it behaves, the way it interacts with people, makes it a little bit less likely than Aedes aegypti of being the type of mosquito that can be involved in a huge outbreak of Zika like we're seeing in Central and South America. Both of these viruses also transmit things like dengue and chikungunya viruses, both of which have been around for a long time and both of which have not led to large-scale outbreaks in New York State or in the United States for that matter. They both lay eggs in domestic water-holding containers, things like buckets, canoes, gutters, flower pots, wheelbarrows, things like that. They live in and around households. They don't fly very far. They only fly a couple hundred yards during the course of their lifetime. They do like to bite people, and they are active during the daytime as well, but they're also will be active around dusk and in some cases even into the night. You may have seen these particular slides in the news or on CDC's website. These are projected distributions of Aedes aegypti on the left-hand side and then Aedes albopictus on the right-hand side. And the main thing that I can tell you about these is that we know we've been collecting mosquitoes in New York State for at least 16 or 17 years since West Nile rolled around. And in certain areas in New York State, particularly New York City and Long Island, they've been collecting mosquitoes for a lot longer than that. Aedes aegypti, while it's hinted at here on the left-hand side of this particular map, we have not seen Aedes aegypti in New York City or Long Island in the past 20 years. You occasionally wind up seeing Aedes aegypti coming off a shipping container. The last that we've known to have seen Aedes aegypti in New York was at one instance in Rockland County in 1973. We do, however, see Aedes albopictus, but we see it in a much more restricted geographic area than what's shown in this particular map that CDC has. This is where we've seen Aedes albopictus in 2016 to date. Aedes albopictus is relatively common in New York City, though those dots aren't on this map, in Nassau County, particularly in western Suffolk County, but also in Rockland County and Westchester County as well. We do not tend to see it further up than that, though we've certainly have been looking this particular summer. And it's a mosquito that's really cold restricted, so we don't expect to find it making it through the winter and really expanding much further north where it's going to be a regular occupant of New York State. So the take-home messages mainly for mosquitoes here is Aedes aegypti is the best vector for Zika, and it's not present in New York. Aedes albopictus might be able to transmit Zika. It's unclear if it's really involved in transmission in the outbreak in Central and South America. It is present in certain parts of New York, down by New York City. It's temperature limited. It has this different behavioral characteristics. It doesn't bite as often and whatnot that makes it less likely to produce outbreaks. There's about 75 different species of mosquito in New York State, and Aedes albopictus is the only one that we have so far that may be implicated in Zika transmission. The other thing I guess I wanted to mention is there's this thought that if you a mosquito bites somebody who has Zika and then that mosquito bites you, they can immediately transmit Zika to you. And that's just not the case as well. If you think of how a mosquito feeds, it in essence is almost two straws, if you will, when that mosquito basically feeds. One straw uses the salivary glands to put saliva into the wound so the blood doesn't necessarily clot, so you don't feel the pain, and so forth. And then the other straw basically draws blood up, and it draws blood up into the mosquito's midgut. For that mosquito then to become infectious or to be able to infect whoever it bites next, the virus actually has to move from that midgut to those salivary glands. And that takes anywhere from 3 to 5 days. So a mosquito that bites someone who's infected with Zika and then bites another person is not going to be able to give that to the person that it just bites until it kind of goes through that process where the virus kind of makes its way from the midgut to the salivary glands. The other thing you may get asked a fair amount of questions about is about prevention and repellent advice for patients. If they are going to travel, if you have to travel to areas with active local Zika transmission, individuals, particularly pregnant women, should probably take precautions to avoid exposure through mosquito bites. There's four different kinds of repellents that are registered by EPA. There's DEET, which has been around forever, picaridin, which is a little bit like DEET, but is much more recent and, to be honest, much more pleasant on the skin. There's IR3535, which is the active ingredient in Avon Skin So Soft products. And then there's oil of lemon eucalyptus, or this paramethane diol, which is basically kind of the chemical formula of oil of lemon eucalyptus. All those are good at repelling against mosquitoes. We always tell people to wind up reading the label instructions and only using as much as they need for what it is that they're going to, the amount of time that they're going to spend outdoors. You don't need to get 100% DEET unless you're going to wind up being outdoors for 36 hours at a time. The lower concentrations of DEET are perfectly appropriate for the amount of time that's mentioned on the label of the bottle that what you're using. We'd also recommend they wear long sleeve shirts and pants. Consider repellent impregnated clothing, which is out there and available. And if you are traveling, you may want, and you're going to keep windows open, you may want to make sure that the screens are in the windows. And if they're not, you may want to consider bed netting.
Okay, so we'll now review a little bit more about other modes of transmission other than mosquito bites through the mosquitoes. So we'll review a little bit about sexual transmission, and of late there's been some updates in this area. So the last MMWR put out by the CDC on July 25th reviewed some much of the data on sexual transmission, and there have been a couple updates since that time. Overall, in looking at the literature, the majority of described cases of sexual transmission of Zika virus are in a male traveler to a non-traveler partner. One description of male to male has occurred, one description of female to male, and one report of Zika RNA in vaginal and cervical fluids, one study with RNA detected in vaginal fluids 3 days after symptom onset and in cervical fluids 11 days after symptom onset. There is one description out of Paris, France, of likely oral sex transmission from male to female. And recently, a new MMWR put out about 2 weeks ago with a report of an asymptomatic male from Maryland with transmission to his female partner after travel. So overall, the majority of cases that have been described in the literature are in symptomatic male travelers with intercourse that occurred shortly before onset, during, or shortly after resolution of an illness consistent with Zika virus. But these other reports are noted, and all, of course, in small numbers at this point. Also of note, Zika virus RNA using PCR technology has been detected in semen up to 6 months after symptom onset. Now, this is detecting RNA and does not necessarily indicate a measure of infectivity, but is important to note as we consider sexual transmission and the implications. So that's what we know at this point. What we don't know, we really don't have a sense of the overall risk of sexual transmission yet, or any specific risk factors that may increase the likelihood of transmission, or the risk of female to male or an asymptomatic male. And importantly, we don't really understand yet the duration of virus persistence in semen. The CDC has an ongoing multi-center study. We are participating here in New York State looking at the duration of virus persistence in semen, but that is data is yet to be available. So recommendations based on all of this data for sexual transmission, if someone's partner is pregnant who has traveled, abstain or condom use throughout the duration of the pregnancy, and consideration of the same for non-pregnant partners. If not pregnant and not trying to conceive, then condoms and adequate contraception. One question that we frequently receive has to do with future pregnancies. If someone travels now, are they at risk if they were to get pregnant 2 years down the line? And so importantly, there's been no evidence that Zika virus will cause congenital infection in pregnancies conceived after resolution of maternal Zika viremia. So what does that mean? What is the exact time period of maternal Zika viremia? At this point, we can present the limited data that we have to date. The incubation period from time of infection to symptom onset is typically about 3 to 14 days. The period of viremia after symptom onset is typically a few days to about 1 week, with the current longest published data in non-pregnant persons having viremia 11 days after symptom onset. This is the time period of maternal viremia. Of course, if the male partner traveled and there is virus in the semen and intercourse occurs, then that is a whole different consideration. So many people have asked, what is the time frame that I should tell my patients to wait before trying to get pregnant? And the CDC in early April came up with some guidance in this regard. For women who have traveled, if they had symptoms of Zika or not, to wait at least 8 weeks after exposure or symptoms onset. For men, and that was after exposure from travel or sexual exposure. For men, after sexual exposure or travel, if they had no symptoms, wait at least 8 weeks after exposure before, and that's a minimum, before trying to conceive. However, if men were diagnosed with Zika virus or had symptoms consistent with Zika virus, the recommendation is to wait at least 6 months. Now, importantly, over the last week and a half, the WHO put out new guidance in this area and is recommending currently for regions with no active transmission of Zika virus, WHO recommends practicing safe sex or abstinence for a period of 6 months for men and women after returning from an area of active transmission to prevent infection through sexual intercourse. Of course, the couple should consistently practice safe sex of vaginal, oral, and anal sex during the waiting period to prevent transmission to the woman planning to conceive. Other modes of transmission. Blood transfusion. There have been reports of blood transfusion-associated transmission. And importantly, in early February, FDA issued recommendations to defer blood donation if individuals had traveled in the last month or had symptoms of Zika virus infection or sexual contact with someone who had traveled in the prior 3 months. Now, importantly, over the last couple weeks, this has been updated. In addition, U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, FDA, has recommended that blood centers, blood establishment centers with locally acquired mosquito-borne cases of Zika should start screening now. So Florida and Puerto Rico already are screening their blood supply, and that neighboring states or those with other epidemiologic linkage or other risk factors should implement screening within 4 weeks. And as you can see here, New York State is listed as one of these high-risk states, and all other states implementing as soon as feasible, but no later than 12 weeks after the document was put out in August. And so as you can see here, blood donation centers are actively engaging in this process to begin screening donor supplies. Importantly, I want you to know that this slide is taken from a slide set that will be presented tomorrow, which will review both this and the theoretical concerns for organ and tissue transplant associated Zika concerns. That will be tomorrow from 12 to 1 p.m. webinar on all transplant-associated potential issues. Another theoretical issue is the concern for breast milk, and I won't go into detail about that here, as there will be next week a session focused on pediatric care, but in general, the CDC is still recommending breastfeeding, given that there have been no reports of transmission via this route. And we'll hold off for a moment on maternal to fetal transmission, but of course that is a route as well, both intrauterine and around the time of labor and delivery. And we'll go more in depth into that in a moment. And then most recently, we added to this slide the question of other modes of transmission. And that's because last week, an MWR was put out regarding an investigation by the CDC and the Utah Health Department looking at an investigation of in a patient with no known risk factors. So patient A had symptoms consistent with Zika virus, fever, rash, conjunctivitis, a positive on PCR and antibody testing for Zika virus, had no travel, no sexual exposure, no blood transfusion, no known mosquito bites. But of note, he had cared for an elderly family member, who we will call the index patient, who had Zika virus after travel to an area with Zika virus abroad. The index patient notably had developed septic shock, multiple organ failure, and died in the hospital. And 2 days before his death, his blood viremia level was 100,000 times higher than the average level reported in persons with Zika virus infection. So an extensive investigation then was undertaken by the CDC and the Utah Department of Health. Multiple other family members who had close contact and cared for this individual were also tested. Sero survey of approximately 90 healthcare providers who took care of this individual as well. These healthcare providers were tested. Community members, more than 200 in the area of the index patient, were assessed and tested. And active vector surveillance near both the index and patient A's residencies was undertaken. All of the testing on all of those individuals has been negative to date, although some of it is still in process. And of note, no Aedes aegypti or Aedes albopictus mosquitoes were identified. Other mosquito types are being tested specifically for Zika. So the conclusion really was that it remains unclear how patient A was infected, but it was known that there was close contact, kissing, caregiving, touching with the index patient while the index patient's viral load was found to be very high. Although it is not certain that these types of close contact were the source of transmission, family contact should be aware that blood and body fluids of severely ill patients might be infectious. And given the recognition of high levels of viremia during that illness, it's essential that healthcare workers continue to apply standard precautions while caring for all patients, including those who might have Zika virus. Now to go a little bit more into maternal to fetal transmission, and again, for today's talk, we'll try to highlight areas of new evidence. So Zika virus infection in pregnancy, an overview. So over the last several months, as more has been learned about Zika virus in pregnancy, there has been data showing adverse pregnancy outcomes, early miscarriages, and late stillbirths, as well as congenital infection. Congenital microcephaly has been spoken about quite frequently, as many of you have heard, but also now a further understanding of other brain abnormalities has come to light, including intracranial calcification, ventriculomegaly, abnormalities of the corpus callosum, cerebral and cerebellar abnormalities, brain atrophy, hydranencephaly, and other the features of brain disruption sequence may be seen with severe microcephaly, overlapping cranial sutures, prominent occipital bone, redundant scalp skin, and neurologic impairment. Other findings described eye abnormalities, seizures, hypertonia, joint abnormalities, clubfoot, and also hearing loss has most recently been described in a publication over the last week. So what exactly is the risk of microcephaly and other congenital defects? Many people want to know this, and they'll come to you as a healthcare provider to ask this question. And the bottom line is that at this point it is unknown. Currently there's a Zika pregnancy registry both in the U.S. and in Puerto Rico, and it aims to really further clarify this and look at the evidence behind what the risk actually is for infants born to mothers with Zika virus infection. And here in New York State, we are participating and in New York City in the Zika pregnancy registry so that any women who have any lab evidence of Zika virus will, they and their infants will be followed for a year out, along with other states and Puerto Rico to better understand the answer to this question. What we know so far is that infection takes place, can take place in any trimester, and that the timing of the Zika exposure associated with severe microcephaly appears to be in the late first and early second trimester, but that Zika infections later in pregnancy can still be associated with poor intrauterine growth and fetal death and poor outcomes. A couple of the key studies here are cited here looking at the risk of microcephaly and other congenital abnormalities. In Brazil, a study by Brazil et al. Looked at 72 confirmed Zika-positive pregnant women, and 42 of those had follow-up fetal ultrasounds and follow-up data on fetal abnormalities. Out of those 42, 12 or 29% had significant findings. Those outcomes included 2 fetal deaths, intrauterine growth restriction in 5, and CNS abnormalities in 7. A retrospective analysis of the 2013 to 2014 Zika virus outbreak in French Polynesia looked at microcephaly alone, not other abnormalities, and this was a retrospective analysis using administrative data. But 8 fetuses and infants with microcephaly were found, and out of the estimated numbers of individuals infected in that outbreak, it was estimated that 1% of fetuses or infants born to women infected with Zika virus during the first trimester had microcephaly. So what do we need to know? We still need to know the relative and absolute risk among infants born to mothers infected at different times during pregnancy, and other factors that may affect a woman's risk of adverse outcomes, such as co-infection with another virus, pre-existing immune response to another flavivirus such as dengue, if there's any genetic background of mother or fetus that affects outcome, or whether the severity of maternal infection or if the mother is asymptomatic or symptomatic affects the risk of adverse outcomes, and what the validated birth prevalence estimates of microcephaly are, both in Brazil and in other countries. And then, of course, the full spectrum of defects, going beyond the brain abnormalities to ocular, hearing, joint, and other more subtle developmental outcomes. And microcephaly is something that we've spoken a lot about and needs to be looked for in pregnant women. But of note, can be difficult to diagnose prenatally, as many of you know. It may be detected by routine ultrasound done at 18 to 20 weeks. However, it is best identified later in pregnancy, late second, early third trimester. And the ultimate diagnosis comes at the time of birth, when the infant's head is head circumference is measured and is less than third percentile for gestation, sex, and age. And the CDC is recommending currently using integral 21st standards, and the link is available here. So ultimately, the goal is to prevent pregnant women from getting Zika virus infection because we have no protective medication or vaccine at this time. And so, as previously mentioned, prevention of travel to these areas, prevention of mosquito bites, as previously mentioned, and prevention of sexual transmission are the key take-home points. And the fact that we as providers need to evaluate all pregnant women and get a travel history on all pregnant women about their travel and their sexual partner's travel. And we recommend providers offer testing for all pregnant women who may have been exposed, whether she is symptomatic or not, at any time after travel. And this is a New York State specific of availability and testing that we can offer, slightly different than the national guidance. We offer at any time after travel during pregnancy, although ideally as soon as possible after symptom onset if there were symptoms, and whether or not the partner, if they were sexually exposed, had symptoms. And in general, this is adapted from a CDC slide about evaluation of pregnant women with possible exposure. But in general, if negative testing and normal ultrasound, routine prenatal care can continue. If positive or inconclusive, consideration of amniocentesis should be individualized, and serial ultrasounds every 3 to 4 weeks should be considered, and testing at the time of birth of both the placenta and infant. And there's more in the webinar available online from yesterday on pregnancy and available next week on pediatrics with more detail on these areas. Just to highlight in discussion with patients about Zika testing, some data out of all of those tested from January 3rd to March 5th in the U.S., out of the 4,500 Zika tests done in the U.S. by the CDC, you can skip down to the third line and see that 2,557 were asymptomatic, and almost all of those were pregnant women, given those were the only asymptomatic people recommended to be tested. Out of those asymptomatic pregnant women, only 7 or 0.3% had confirmed Zika virus infection. Of those 7, 5 had resided during pregnancy in areas of active Zika virus transmission. So the important take-home message here is that most asymptomatic pregnant women who receive testing do not have Zika virus infection, and it's a low proportion in asymptomatic pregnant women, and that is reassuring and important for us to know as we counsel our patients. Of course, given the severe consequences, we still recommend testing in these women, but this can help in the discussion and counseling with your patients as you discuss these issues. And then we can turn a bit to testing. So what testing is available for Zika virus? There's a PCR test available to detect virus in the blood and urine, and there's an antibody test. We have two types of antibody testing available currently right now, screening antibody test, and if a screen is positive, a more specific antibody test called the plaque reduction neutralization test, or PRNT, that aims to detect a fourfold rise in titers and Zika antibodies in paired sera. And this is a nice chart on looking at the timing of viremia and antibody response. And there will be more presented on this at the upcoming webinars as well on lab testing tomorrow and next week. But looking at detecting Zika virus RNA, you can see that right before symptom onset and approximately a week after symptom onset is when we expect the blood to be positive for viral RNA. And then about a week after, slightly before potentially, we expect the IgM antibody to start to rise. So the Zika IgM ELISA is part of the antibody screening testing that we offer here in New York State and is expected to be positive approximately 2 to 12 weeks after infection. And we also offer a flavivirus total antibody test, which may remain positive after that time period, more than 12 weeks after infection. The screening serology takes about 7 days from time of specimen receipt at the lab. And if it's negative, suggests no infection unless it's early after infection. And as seen in the chart one slide prior, that could be a window period. And so testing will need to be repeated. If positive, it will need confirmatory testing as it's a screening antibody test. And so it could be a true positive or a false positive. That additional confirmatory testing, the PRNT, can take an additional 10 to 14 days due to the length of time it takes for the virus to actually grow in culture. So the test is quite time consuming. And that PRNT is more specific and can measure the titer of antibodies comparing an acute and convalescent specimen. And it takes time, given it takes time, it's a biological assay that looks at interaction of the virus that is growing in cell culture and antibody in the blood and looking to see if it inactivates virus so it can no longer replicate in cell culture. Importantly, over the last few months, we've learned more about testing for Zika virus. And so one update is the importance of urine PCR testing. And so an MMWR from May highlighting Florida data, and we've seen similarly in New York State, have highlighted that urine specimens collected from 70 symptomatic patients from 0 to 20 days after symptom onset, 93% of those tested positive on urine PCR, and only 56% of those on concurrent serum testing were positive. So this really highlights, and we've had a similar experience in New York State, the importance of getting both urine and PCR testing concurrently for Zika virus testing. Additionally, over the last several months, we've learned that in pregnant women, the virus may persist in the blood. So prior data suggests that viremia lasts approximately a week after symptom onset, as mentioned, in non-pregnant persons. But a case report was presented in a New England Journal of a pregnant woman with serum PCR positivity at 4 weeks and 10 weeks after symptom onset, but not after delivery. And fetal infection was confirmed, and there were significant brain abnormalities on fetal MRI. Also, in obstetrics and gynecology, further cases highlighting persistent positivity in pregnant women were noted in a recent publication. The prognostic significance of this is unknown. So going now to new updates of commercial testing. So commercial testing most recently has become available over the last few months by various commercial labs, some performing serum PCR only, others serum, urine, and or IgM, and others serum, plasma, urine, and or IgM. And each EHR system may have a different process for how to order these. So if ordering commercial testing, one has to be very aware of what they're ordering exactly and to anticipate how to interpret this and determine if all of the panel of testing that should be done was done for your case. The negative predictive value of a given test is highly dependent on timing, as has previously been noted, and the IgM can be positive but can be cross-reactive with other flaviviruses such as dengue or yellow fever vaccine. And so comprehensive serologic evaluation is important in high-risk cases, and that would include evaluation of total antibodies against flaviviruses by microsphere immunofluorescence assay and PRNT, and that is currently not available through commercial labs. So for diagnostic testing through the Wadsworth Center, the New York State Department of Health Public Health Lab is recommended for pregnant women and other high-risk individuals, immunosuppressed individuals, infants, and other high-risk individuals living in New York State outside of New York City. This comprehensive testing is including urine and blood PCR and all of the serology mentioned. And this consistent approach to testing, the PCR followed by serology as indicated, is provided irrespective of estimated timing of exposure. And this can be arranged by contacting the local health department where the individual resides, as previously discussed, and here is a link for further information. Testing through the New York City Department of Health Public Health Lab is recommended for pregnant women and high-risk individuals as well, and that should be arranged in consultation with the city health department. And this New York City provider access line to arrange this is 1-866-692-3641, as listed here, Monday to Friday, 9 to 5. For those individuals outside of New York City, the provider will need three things to give to their patient: the lab order to the patient or to the lab for Zika testing, an infectious disease requisition form, and available at that link previously noted that the provider will fill out, and contacting the local health department to get authorization and an authorization form for the testing, and they can help with further logistics. This is for testing at the New York State Public Health Lab Wadsworth Center when that's desired. This is processes not required for commercial testing, as commercial testing folks can follow their routine processes. And finally, to touch on interpretation of serology results, as noted, false negatives can occur with early testing. And so if the specimen is collected within 1 week of symptom onset, or if asymptomatic within 3 weeks after last exposure, a convalescent specimen should be drawn 3 weeks after the first to rule out infection. Again, false positives can occur given cross-reactivity, and PRNT may help distinguish those false positives, but there are times when it may still be difficult and we may not be able to distinguish between the flaviviruses. And this is a bit of a cheat sheet we put together for folks on how to interpret. I've already gone through this, but here it's put in a table form. If the PCR is detected, that is considered infection is confirmed and no further testing is required. However, if the IgM or arbovirus total antibody microsphere immunofluorescence assay are positive, a PRNT must be performed to confirm. And if the PRNT is positive, there may need to be ideally with PRNT paired acute and convalescent sera. Occasionally with pregnant women, what we can do is a single specimen PRNT so things can be done in a more timely fashion. And given the complexity of interpretation, our Zika information line and for any other questions is available to providers and the public here at 1-888-364-4723 weekdays from 9 to 5 for any public health consultation for assistance. We have some resources available here. And again, as previously mentioned, these webinars will be posted on our Zika virus webpage under healthcare providers additional information. And we'd like to acknowledge the New York City Department of Health, the CDC, and the New York State Wadsworth Center and Congenital Malformations Registry. And again, we have here for your information the flyer of the previous webinars, which will be posted. The last one was yesterday and today's, one tomorrow at noon, next Wednesday at noon, and then next Thursday from 6 to 8 p.m., all of which will be available afterwards as well. And we can take questions now. Thank you. First, we can look to our, if any recurrent questions have come up on our webinar question panel. Let me see if we have any here. Doesn't look like there have been any that are particularly recurrent that we want to highlight here, so we're happy to open the line for questions.
At this time, I would like to remind everyone, in order to ask a question over the phone, please press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. We'll pause for just a moment to compile the Q&A roster. Again, if you would like to ask a question, press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. And your first question comes from the line of Richard. Your line is open.
I just may have misheard in the beginning the incidence of Zika in Puerto Rico. I saw one comment that said 5,582 cases, but then I saw another slide that says 17,000. Did I get that wrong, or is there some confusion there?
No, you did see that correctly. So I'm sorry, the one slide looking at 5,580 was to give folks a sort of general gist on the Guillain-Barré slide. So that was with a certain time frame of when they were able to look at passive surveillance for Guillain-Barré. Of course, the 34 cases of Guillain-Barré that had evidence of a prior Zika or flavivirus infection were in that time frame when there was 5,580 Zika virus cases reported in Puerto Rico as confirmed and probable from November to July 7th. The 17,000 are all cases for Puerto Rico up till September 14th. And they have a particular note on the CDC website that recently there may have been a large increase in recent weeks as well, because some retroactive inputting of cases has been added. So I think that accounts for the difference, both the extensive retroactive work they're doing as well as the months between beginning of July and September 14th.
Thank you.
There are no further questions at this time. I will turn the call back over to the presenters.
Okay, well, this is actually sort of convenient because we're just about at 1 o'clock anyway. If there are no further questions, we'll say thanks for coming on to listen today. Again, we'll point out that there are going to be another webinar tomorrow, another webinar next week, and then one next week, and then
second
one
next week evening.
Yeah, and then one the following next week evening in at Stony Brook. But that will also be a webinar that you could dial into as well. And again, all these webinars are going to get posted on our website. Basically, if you just search NYSDOH Zika, you'll get to the webpage that way. You could always go to health.ny.gov, which is the main website as well, and you'll see links there. Give us a couple of days for the webinars to actually wind up getting posted, and you'll be able to see these particular slides. So again, if there's no further questions, operator.
You do have one more question from the line of Marianne. Your line is open.
Yes, I just was wondering the number in comparison to Florida. I had the same problem as the previous gentleman. I did see that Florida had a total of 639, that New York had 685, but then I saw a total for New York State of 752 on another slide.
Yeah, so the main difference there is there's a time lag between what CDC reports and what we're reporting. So
excellent.
The Florida versus New York State slide is basically one that uses the CDC reported data, so it sort of compares apples to apples. The number that we reported a little later, the 780 or so number, that's one that's a little more up to date for us here in New York State.
And what would that be as of what date for that 752? I'll just share that with my team after the call and let them know that these will be posted in a few days or a week. What was the effective date of 752?
I believe it was September 16. We're trying
that's
to
what
slide
I thought.
Back.
That's exactly what I thought. It says
September 12. Sorry.
Beautiful, because yesterday's New York Times was loaded with articles on Zika, but I didn't get to read them, so this is very helpful.
Okay, so, great.
Thank you so much, guys.
Yep.
And there are no further questions.
Okay, with that then, thanks for spending your lunch with us, and tune in to any of the other webinars that are going to happen over the next 2 weeks. Thanks.
This concludes today's conference call. You may now disconnect.